Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Berta, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, April 16th. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about racism and healthcare. No funny quip from me here. Specifically, we're going to talk about the CDC declaring that racism is a serious public health threat, and new research that shows how racial disparities have shown up in hospitals and emergency rooms with COVID patients. To discuss these important topics are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchinson, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
No quips from me either. We've had another police shooting of a young man, Adam Toledo, from the Little Village neighborhood in Chicago. So it's very sober and somber here.
Yeah. Julie, how are you?
Oh, sorry to hear that. I guess I'm better. I had my second shot 2 days ago. I've been feeling quite sluggish with a huge headache, but I'll take it.
Okay. Thanks, Julie. Now, before we talk about racism and healthcare, we have to talk about the other elephant in the room this week, and that's the pause in the distribution of the COVID-19 vaccine from Johnson & Johnson. Dave, what's the short-term and long-term impact of that pause on vaccine distribution plans here in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, it's very unfortunate. Exceptionally small numbers of J&J vaccine recipients, 6 people out of 7 million doses administered, have developed severe form of blood clots, which has led to the pause. Like the AstraZeneca vaccine, which hasn't been approved for use in the U.S. yet, J&J's vaccine uses viral vector technology, which is different from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which use messenger RNA technology. So from a distribution perspective, the good news is that Pfizer and Moderna vaccines can move full speed ahead. On the negative side, we temporarily lose the one-and-done vaccine for the difficult-to-reach populations like homeless people, and there will be some disruption of the overall vaccine supply chain. Longer term, though, I don't see this as being overly disruptive.
Got it. Thanks, Dave. Julie, what do you see as the impact of the pause on vaccine hesitancy and maybe vaccines in general?
Yeah, I don't know if I totally agree with Dave. From the folks I've talked to on the ground, you know, people who are either working in health systems trying to deploy vaccines or those working at centers, this is creating a much bigger concern than the 1 in a million chance a blood clot would lead you to think. And I don't know if you've seen some of the data that's been going around on social about how birth control pills have a much greater chance of blood clots than the J&J vaccine. So I think there's some disproportionate news going on out there, but I have heard women who are, you know, outside the band of the age of those impacted say they'd never take that vaccine now, and it makes them more hesitant for those kinds of vaccines. And I've actually heard men on both sides of this. So it's pretty interesting. I think it's going to have some lingering effects, but I guess I agree with Dave. It's, you know, a couple of years from now, I don't think this is going to be something we still talk about.
Got it. Thanks, Julie.
Just to clarify, Dave, I agree on the hesitancy front. I was focused primarily on supply. I think we're going to have plenty of vaccines. Now the challenge is getting people to take them, which has been the challenge already, and now it just gets a little harder.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think from a public health emergency standpoint, I do hope it's a temporary glitch. But from the perspective of an individual taking that vaccine, I mean, I do think it's pretty scary, especially for young women who seem to be at most risk for an adverse event. So we'll see. We'll all hope it works out. Now, speaking of adverse events, this is a big one, racism in healthcare. Let's talk about it. Dave, tell us what the CDC said and why you think that's an important statement from a public policy perspective.
Well, Dave, it hasn't taken very long for new CDC director Michelle Walensky to put her stamp on the nation's largest public health organization, using the unambiguous fact that COVID-19 has had a disproportionately negative impact on communities of color. Director Walensky specifically identified racism as, and I quote, a serious public health threat that directly affects the well-being of millions of Americans, close quote. She also highlights, again, quote, the structural barriers that impact racial and ethnic groups differently to influence where a person lives, where they work, where their children play, and where they gather in the community, close quote. This is very clear, very powerful language. And Director Walensky has identified racism as a specific social determinant of health, along with other social determinants, including housing, transportation, education, and nutrition. And the government just hasn't done that before, so it's a big deal. So what is the CDC proposing to do now that the U.S. government has identified racism as a public health threat? Four things. First, conduct research to study and document how racism shapes health outcomes, as well as measuring the effectiveness of specific policy actions. Secondly, to make new and expanded investments in racial and ethnic minority communities. More on this in a second. Third, expand internal CDC efforts to foster greater diversity and inclusion. And finally, launching a new CDC web portal on racism and health to inform public opinion and catalyze a constructive national dialogue. So why is this important from a public policy's perspective? I have three observations. First, former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel stressed the importance of not wasting a crisis. So Director Walensky is expertly using the COVID-19 crisis to highlight a critical health policy issue that's really been with us since the founding of the country and to shape the political discourse on that issue. This takes courage to do, and she's doing it exceptionally well. Secondly, none of this is new. Over 170 organizations, including the AMA, have already identified racism as a public health crisis or emergency, making its declaration. What the CDC is doing is stating an obvious but previously unacknowledged truth by our government that racism impacts public health. Former Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter said sunshine is the best disinfectant. Walensky's put a policy stake in the ground on racism that will influence health policy dialogue for the foreseeable future. Third and finally, I'm really impressed by how organized and choreographed the Biden administration is being in rolling out its policy agenda. It was just 2 weeks ago, March 31st, that the president announced the first phase of his $3 trillion infrastructure bill. That part cost $2 trillion. It includes investments in housing, education, clean water, and transportation, among other priorities to address racial and economic inequities. Now comes the CDC declaring racism as a public health threat. This provides policy rationale for the president's infrastructure priorities. That's quite a two-step. It really seems that the Biden administration is playing to win right now.
Thanks, Dave. Well done. Julia, what does the CDC's statement add to the dialogue on racism from your perspective? And what do you see as the short and long-term effects of the agency taking that position?
Well, first, I'd love to stop to acknowledge the great Lindsay behind the scenes here, who's pointed out to us that this is the fourth annual Black Maternal Health Week this week, and April is National Minority Health Month. So I think the timing of the CDC is quite something, and thank you, Lindsay. You know, when I look at this, taking a step back, the way that we need to reap the benefits of this kind of statement and stake in the ground is really through systemic change. And the first step CDC has taken here is to name this issue and put racism's effect on health out in the open to force organizations to take it into consideration, to design around it, to incentivize, to eliminate it. I mean, this just will set off a whole litany of action over the coming years, hopefully. And first, I'd just like to talk about caregivers. You might recall my raising the work of Vocera and a number of leading health systems work on patient safety a few weeks ago. And they talked about how patients will be safer when caregivers feel safe. And one of the three recommendations they made was around promoting health justice and being clear about racism in the workplace. So naming racism isn't just for people and patients, but for caregivers throughout the system. And this will certainly be part of a big systemic solution. But of course, because of my background, I look at the data. And Deborah Duran, who's a PhD from the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities, noted that there are many states out there today that aren't even collecting race and ethnicity data on vaccines or COVID cases. And the absence of this information makes it more difficult to even acknowledge or understand the issue or the gaps in care after all this. And as we know, we're increasingly relying on the use of AI and machine learning and all sorts of technology to diagnose everything from skin cancer to looking at a CT scan to identify stroke to detecting potential cancers in a colonoscopy. And these digital diagnostics, I love, they hold incredible promise for our system, but we all know that they're not trained with all the data that represents the entire population. So the data can really benefit from what's happening here in ways that will, I think, really help everyone through technology innovation. And further, we know there's been bias in medical research, so we can change a lot there. We know the medical education curricula could certainly use more education about the social issues and what is underlying here. And we know that we can do a lot on the policy front from here.
And for those of you who don't know, Lindsay Morrison is Foresight Health's Managing Director. She's the one behind the scenes that pulls all the right levers. So thank you, Lindsay, very much. Dave, anything to add to Julie's comments?
Well, I'll pile on with the Lindsay comments. She definitely makes the train run on time. With regard to the topic at hand, it is exceptionally important that the government is now acknowledging racism specifically as a social determinant of health.
Got it, Dave. Thank you. Now, Julie, let's talk about this new CDC research on racial disparities in COVID hospitalizations and ER visits. What did the research show and why are the findings important?
Well, there were two reports. The first report looked at discharge data from March to December 2020. And the CDC found that the proportion of hospitalized patients with COVID was highest for Hispanic and Latino patients and pretty much across all four census regions in the U.S. So geography was not a huge factor here. And of course, these disparities declined over the course of the pandemic as we had more hospitalizations among non-Hispanic white. But they persisted through most recently as December, and most notably with Hispanic patients in the West. So pretty big issues they found. The second study, very similar, looked at COVID-related emergency department visits in 13 states between October and December. They found that Hispanic or American Indian or Alaska Native people were 1.7 times more likely to seek care than white people, 1.7. And Black people were 1.4 times more likely to seek COVID-related care in the ED than white people. So these reports are important because they shine a light on what Dave talked about earlier. The exposure to risk is not equally distributed, and the access and uptake of vaccines in particular right now are further challenged in these populations, which will put them and our entire society's recovery at further risk. Black people make up about 12% of the U.S. population, and only about 8.4% have received at least one dose of the vaccine. And 18% of the U.S. population identifies as Hispanic or Latino, and only 10.7% are shown as receiving those vaccinations. And I think we all know that the data that's being collected on people's racial and ethnic backgrounds for these vaccines is not clean. So it's very hard to know where we are as a country. But these reports underscore the need to address health inequities in general, and certainly in our vaccine efforts. So the CDC is pushing for more vaccinations in hard-hit communities, increased access and uptake with community health workers, and frankly, more testing efforts as well in underserved communities.
Thanks, Julie, and thank you, data, right? I mean, that's important. Dave, how does the research feed into the CDC's new position, and what's the takeaway for people on the ground, not just treating COVID patients, but treating all patients?
Well, amen on data. We're all about the data at Foresight Health. The only thing I'd add to Julie's excellent synopsis is that about 10% of people that have COVID are experiencing long COVID symptoms, and they disproportionately affect people who've been hospitalized. So to the extent that communities of color are being hospitalized with COVID to a much greater extent than the general population, it's also logical to assume they'll be disproportionately affected by long COVID. And I think that poses a very severe future health problem for the country as a whole with long COVID, but particularly for these communities. In terms of the bigger picture, I'm going to deviate slightly from your question, Dave. I serve on the board of the Community Builders, which is the largest developer of low-income communities, neighborhoods in the United States. And what really impresses me about this organization is their commitment to something they call community life. It's building houses or housing units isn't enough. You actually have to create neighborhoods that are safe and enhance community well-being. They have to be places where people actually want to live. And so language is important. I've started thinking increasingly about people, places, and things. And as we talk about more broadly social determinants of health, you know, how do we make it better for people in terms of access and also for the caregivers, as Julie is always importantly reminding us, places, how do we decentralize care? How do we make it easier to access? And then the things, the products and services that really deliver better health outcomes. So I'd like us to stop talking about social determinants of health and start talking about social or investment multipliers of health and improve the community life, to steal TCB's phrase, for all Americans.
Julie, anything to add to Dave's comments?
Well, first, I love the investment twist. I think it's a great way to be thinking productively and proactively about it. And, you know, I would just say that COVID is, again, teaching us that those who are in difficult living situations in crowded housing, or perhaps need to go to work when they're sick, they have no choice. They are more likely to certainly be infected with COVID, but also other issues as well. There's a lot more that we need to be doing to look at our neighborhoods that we've underinvested in for years, and environmental hazards and food deserts, and the kinds of things that have been looked at for a long time on the philanthropic side, but are starting to come into commercial view. And the investment mindset that Dave put out there is fantastic.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Well said. I do have a feeling we'll be revisiting this topic a few more times. All right. Now, as always on the roundup, let's talk about next week. Julie, what's the big news in healthcare next week?
Well, unfortunately, I think the two letters for you are still J and J. We're going to keep hearing about this for a few weeks and a lot of hysteria out there in certain pockets taking advantage of this, unfortunately.
Got it. Dave, what's on top of your healthcare news tickler file next week?
The other big elephant in the room is police violence and gun violence. We've had another police shooting in Minneapolis that's causing protests. I mentioned the Chicago shooting at the top of the podcast. And we just had another major mass shooting in Indiana last night. So unfortunately, we keep trying as a society, I think, to ignore gun violence, but it keeps representing itself into the dialogue. So at some point, we got to do something about it.
Yeah, it's a near daily occurrence every time I turn on the news. All right, Dave, thank you. And thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming services. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.